Hey, it's Rob. It was an amazing week of Survivor, and we had incredible podcasts with Christian Hubicki and Steven on the Know-It-Alls. Make sure you catch those as well. Plus, The Circle was back this week with an AI contestant. Taryn, Mike Bloom, and Puya broke down the first week of drops from The Circle and on Renap. Who did Sam Moore find for the big guest? Find out on this week's Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast, all right here on RHAP. We know reality TV.
Hello, I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told.
Subscribe to our feed on robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed to get your true crime on Tuesdays. Sarah, what are we talking about today?
Well, today let's open the file. We watched My Daughter's Killer. It's a feature documentary, so Mari's, you know, dancing around the house, but it's not a series. Feature documentary directed by Antoine Tassin. He has written and directed a few shorts before. This is his first feature. It's in French and German, so you can watch it on Netflix with subs or dubs, although we have opinions about that. Not judgment, just opinions with this particular property about the dubbing. But we can't discuss it alone. We have a wonderful guest with us, elephant enthusiast, seltzer fanatic, and host of the RHAP Drag Race podcast, Beth Dixon. Beth Dixon, how are you?
Well, I love that those are the three things that I'm known for the most. It's just like seltzer, elephants, drag. And I just think of a wonderful elephant drinking some seltzer and drag. Yeah, that'd be like my ultimate dream right there.
Says elephant.
Says elephant.
That's good.
But no, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited to chat about my first true crime documentary. Well, it's a podcast, but I've watched others in the past. But I'm excited for my first true crime podcast appearance.
You have opinions.
I do. I know it's hard to believe that I, a person who talks about drag every week, has opinions about something. But I do. I do have a few opinions about specifically the storytelling and structure of this documentary. So I'm excited to get into it.
Wonderful. Before we do, what's your true crime origin story? How did you get into watching true crime and what types do you like? What's your relationship with true crime, I suppose?
Yeah, you know, I've listened to kind of true crime podcasts on and off. My favorite murder was something that my friends had introduced me to. So therefore, of course, I feel like I had like the traditional basic route into podcast of My Favorite Murder. But I also, I think when I was younger and growing up, I always liked when you'd have like those like Dateline specials or something. And then we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get into the recommendations, but a crime happened near me in upstate New York, the very top of New York State. And even though I didn't live there at the time, I knew a lot of the players involved on all sides. And so that really, once that made national attention and started, there were shows and datelines and documentaries being made there. It really encouraged me to check out what other documentaries, podcasts were out there.
Great. Well, it's good to have you on the scene and podcasting for your first true crime. So let's talk about the crime. Kalinka Bamberski was 15 when she died at the home of her stepfather, Dr. Dieter Krombach, in 1982. Her death was ruled as a natural causes from heat stroke, although her autopsy revealed regurgitated food in her windpipe and trauma to her outer labia. Her father, André Bamberski, believed that Krombach had killed her. A German court found Krombach not guilty, although he was tried in absentia in France, found guilty and sentenced to 15 years. Bamberski kept tabs on Krombach for 39 years, eventually conspiring to abduct him from Germany to France to face his sentence. In 2011, Krombach was tried in France and sentenced to 15 years in prison. He obtained early release in 2020 for health reasons and died in Germany in late 2020. Just to backtrack on Dr. Krombach, he was investigated in the 1970s over the suspicious death of his first wife, although he was never charged. In 1997, he admitted to drugging a 16-year-old patient and raping her. According to him, she didn't say yes, but she didn't say no. He was given a 2-year suspended sentence for that, and his medical license was revoked. He was then convicted of practicing medicine without a license and served 22 months of his 28-month sentence in prison. So he got prison for practicing without a license, but not for raping a 16-year-old girl. During his trial for the death of Kalinka, two women gave evidence about being raped by Krombach, with other women also named. And to date, 16 women have come forward to attest to his sexual assaults, some of them when they were children. And as we know, sexual assault is grievously underreported. So 16 multiplied by. Andre Bamberski, Kalinka's father, received a 1-year suspended sentence for initiating the abduction. And Andre Krasniki, who carried out the abduction with two Russians, received a 1-year sentence, and his own father visited him in prison to tell him how proud he was of him. So before we dive into details, Beth, just your overall thoughts on the documentary. What are your first impressions?
You know, in terms of the crime itself or the storytelling, what would you
wherever
prefer?
Wherever you want to go.
Okay. No. Well, I mean, the way I hate this man is like it just shows that, you know, I have obviously a very American point of view. Mm-hmm. I know what it is, unfortunately, like to be a victim of sexual violence, but I also know that in many cases, I guess the U.S. has been a little ahead of the curve, which is really sad to say because we really aren't amazing at it. The fact that well into the 90s that this man who was admitted to drugging and essentially basically admits to raping this 16-year-old girl, and that there's a history and that his first wife was 24 when she passed, when I think he was like much older than her. There's a lot of power dynamics here, and there's like a lot of passes that we learn that Germany has had and how France deals with things differently. And I found that to be a really interesting angle for a documentary. This makes it such an interesting story to tell on top of how many, you know, horrific things and details that we hear. The story really is how do two different countries and the citizens within them navigate this crime, and how does justice eventually come? And that to me was a really fascinating look. It's not just we're looking at one justice system. We're dealing with multiple, and also the cultural implications that surround both of those justice systems. So to me, I thought it was a really interesting story. And so happy he got justice, but also, you know, he gets released. I'm like, no, stay behind bars. Why are you out here? Oh, yeah. There's so many crimes he committed. Yes.
So many.
Yes. Murray,
I was just going to say good point, because the crime itself happens in Germany. But because Kalinka is a French citizen, France is able to, and her father is also a French citizen, and her father is the one who basically kind of convinces the French police to investigate, and they open up their own investigation. And then, of course, the French investigation is way different from the German ones, because they're like, hey, something happened here? While Germany was kind of like, natural causes, you know, and because of that, that's, right, fill in the blank. Yeah, that's why he was able to kind of he would get away with it in Germany, but France, like Sarah said, tried him in absentia and found him guilty. It's very interesting, the different dynamics between two countries that are like right next to each other. That was like a subplot that you didn't see coming, but the main story, I guess, spoiler alert for my ratings, I really enjoyed this film. I might be jaded because we just watched like back to back, not just docuseries, but like, you know, another documentary that, you know, took liberties with some of the settings and the timeline. This felt like, is it, it's weird to say good. The storytelling to me was done really, really well. And we can get into that deeper, but that just up top, I feel like this is one of the better properties that we've watched when it comes to like a solo crime and how it was told.
Yeah, look, I agree with you both. It is, I think we can say it's good in that the documentary is a good piece of work.
It is.
There were some very interesting themes that the director just allowed to bubble up, you know, fathers obviously being a very strong one. But the power differential, very interesting, not only male to female power differential, older to younger, but also the continual description of Krombach as a charming man, an affable man. And he was a doctor. So in Germany, doctors are revered. So this idea of, oh, well, a doctor, if he was a doctor, he couldn't possibly have done it. So by his very self as a doctor, he can't have done it. And one of the women that we hear from much later when Krombach is finally tried in France, she was a cleaner. And he drugged her and raped her. And she didn't tell anybody because he was a doctor and she was a cleaner. And she doesn't even go on to say, and who would believe? She doesn't even have to. We are now so steeped in the privilege of this man and the way that those surrounding him treated him. In fact, his lawyer, we hear from a lot of lawyers in this documentary, which I found very interesting.
Yeah.
But his German lawyer, no, actually, I'm sorry, he was a French lawyer who spoke German fluently. Yves Lovano describing the German decision that there was no foul play says, oh, well, what did he have? One, two, three, four, five accomplices to help him cover up this murder? Well, he did.
Yeah.
They were accomplices either by active participation or by allowing themselves to be blinded as to who this man actually was. And unfortunately, and we will get into this later, Danielle Gonin, Kalinka's mother, was also there. I don't want to talk too much about her now, but we've had some great questions about Danielle, which we'll touch on later. So let's get into the documentary. It starts with Anton, who we don't know who he is. He ends up to be the abductor. He talks about what would you do as a father? What are you capable of doing for your child? And these are virtually the first words we hear. So this is a bit of a thesis, I think, for the movie. And the documentary starts with a discovery of the bound and beaten man in a small village in France, which turns out to be Krombach after his abduction. From there, they don't play games with the timeline, as Mari said. They just they start there, they give us that, and then they go back to the beginning, to the death of Kalinka. What, Beth, what did you think about the structure of the documentary?
I really enjoyed it. I thought that, you know, sometimes we have to wait and it's like they're supposed to. I feel like a lot of times they're trying to make you feel like there's a mystery that you're trying to solve as it goes on. I like that we're not being fooled into that. Here's the end game, essentially, without knowing what the crime or like what the court is, what the how justice is served. Here is this man that who's been beaten and bound, and you hear somebody talking about what would you do as a father, and then you cut right to Kalinka's killing and or murder. And I like that we're getting right into it. We're not. I love that kind of storytelling because it sets up the theme and goes, here's your theme. Here's what's going to happen to the perpetrator. Let's go from the beginning and go. And rather than trying to sit there and question everything, I mean, you start putting your thoughts and your reflections more into the culture, the into what's happening, rather than trying to figure out all the details yourself. I oftentimes feel like when I listen to true crime podcasts or watch a documentary that I just kind of feel like we're supposed to be unraveling something, like we're supposed to be the detectives and we're supposed to be doing this legwork. And I like that we're not doing that here. It doesn't allow for me to miss details in the sense that I might be spending more time thinking about what's the cultural implication of this or why would he think this way and question my own perceptions and biases and such in the moment as well. Whereas I can't do that if I'm also trying to solve the crime as it's happening. So True. In terms of storytelling, I really like how this is presented. There are just a couple of issues that I have with it. There are sometimes I have a hard time following who the person is that we're supposed to, that we're listening from or listening to. They don't do a great job of saying like, here's who this person is all the time.
Yeah.
And that made it really, I did have to rewind about four times because one thing that I think is really incredible, and we can spend some time chatting about this if you'd like, is the mother is not really featured at all. She's mentioned, she's not featured. She's not interviewed. Everything we hear from her is third person, or second person, but we don't actually hear from her herself. And there were so many times where they would mention the mother and then cut to somebody else. And I thought that was the mother. And then I was like, this doesn't make sense contextually. Did I miss something early? And then I found out, no, it's just another one of his victims. It's not the mother. And so I found myself getting confused in that way. But whether or not that's because of dubbing, and I don't speak French or German, but they do have English dubbing happening over that. I think maybe all of that just made it a little difficult, but that's the only complaint I have with it. It was hard for me sometimes to realize who was talking.
I mean, I watched it with subtitles, I must say. And then when I went to do the rewatch, I turned on the dubbing just so I could take my notes, and I had to turn it off again. Murray, did you find the balance between the original speakers and the dubbed voices too great, like we did with Gladbeck?
I had to watch it dubbed this time because I just did not have the time to on both watches to sit and watch it, like give it all of my attention to it, to watch it with just subtitles. So the dubbing, I thought I was pretty fine with it. Again, I do hate the underlayer of the original track under it. The good thing about this one in comparison to Gladbeck, I think they picked the dubbing timing better, because sometimes it was almost like they did it like maybe a hair behind the original or a hair before it, so that it's not directly overlapped like Gladbeck, if that makes sense. Like I did not feel as overwhelmed as I did with Gladbeck. And with Gladbeck, I thought that the story warranted like doing the subs, because like we said in that one, the emotion comes out better with listening to the original audio. For this, I did not feel like I missed anything having the dubs on, because I don't think, you know, it was a fairly straightforward documentary process where we're going through the story, we're having talking heads directly talking to us. So it's not like the moment or the situation was happening like in Gladbeck.
Good. That's good. I mean, we never want to ding the documentary maker because of the dubbing, is obvious. Yes, that's later. But that's actually really good to hear, because I don't want people to be put off watching it because it's in French and German. Barry, the structure of the documentary, the beginning, how did that strike you?
I actually very much enjoyed it. And I think I enjoyed it even more once I finished it and once I went back and watched it again, because the way that they started off with like Beth saying, like, we get the 911 call of like, oh, there's a man, he's beaten and tied here. Like, I didn't know this documentary. Documentary's name is My Daughter's Killer. The, you know, the little caption is like, oh, how far will a father go? You know, I was like, oh, did he kill that man? Like, they don't tell you in the beginning. Like, they tell you that he's beaten. They said he's really badly beaten, and they leave it there. So the whole time I'm kind of approaching it like, okay, so what happened to make this father get to this point where he may have murdered this man? Because I'm not going to lie, I'm here for true crime. I'm thinking the man got murdered. I'm not, you know, yeah. And that's not why I like the beginning, but I like that, like Beth said, we know where it's going. So it's kind of like, instead of trying to figure out what happens, it's kind of like, okay, so I'm paying attention to see how it gets here, not trying to guess where it goes. And Anton, starting out, just, we don't know who he is to this story. And then the quote unquote twist of him being revealed as one of the abductors. I was like, oh, it was like a twist in a good way. Like, I really hate like going back to, you know, something we've already reviewed, but with what we just talked about with I Just Killed My Dad, like some of the manufactured twist in that documentary, I had a lot of problems with. While in this one, I felt it was very authentic, and it was just the way that the story was told led to some shock value, not manufacturing something in order for it to garner shock value. I just think the linear of the events just merited a little bit of just surprises along the way. I agree with Beth. I didn't know who any of these people were, to be quite honest. I think I missed the lower thirds on the people's names and their occupations like more times than not. I was just going with it.
They didn't have them sometimes. Like when I would go back and rewind, they didn't have them. And whether that was to protect an anonymity or whatever, I don't know. And that's completely valid and fine. But even just something that just says like, redacted or something would have been like great to be like, oh, okay. Or even just like a little narration moment that says like, you know, one of his victims is here to speak.
Yeah.
Cause I'm sitting there going like, wait,
didn't know.
The mother is now testifying against him. Like what is happening? And I was like, oh, that's not happening. Okay. I'm making this.
They named everybody, but only once. The only person they didn't name was the cleaner. She wasn't given a title. I mean, her name obviously would be in the court documents, but and she was there clearly who she was. Very brave to not only testify, but then to come on the documentary. And here was the only sort of it's not artifice because it actually happened, but the director chooses to leave it in where she says, oh, can I please take a break? And she gets up and leaves the table. And interestingly enough, the person interviewing her that we hear is a woman's voice. So that was an interesting choice. And I was happy for the director to leave that in.
You know what I think is interesting, though, now that I'm thinking about this, and I only watched it the one time, I haven't gone back and watched it, but maybe I can ask this of the two of you who have now watched it a couple of times. Knowing that the father is making the 911 call in the very beginning, does that change the opening scene with the 911 call, the emergency call?
Well, technically, he's not making the 911 call. He calls the police station and he's on the phone with them as they go and find the doctor. That's what I thought, right, Sarah?
Yeah. So the dispatcher is talking to the gendarme who are going to find the beaten man in an alleyway amongst the rubbish bins. They go there. There is footage. Contemporary footage and contemporaneous footage of the alleyway. And by the time we go back to it, we go, yes, you should be in a alleyway by rubbish bins. Dreadful man.
Yeah. But it's just an interesting thing, I think, to think about. When the opening scene happens, you would never have thought, oh, well, the father actually called in. So I don't know if that changes like, oh yeah, the father tipped it up. But just an interesting thought that I hadn't thought about until we were just talking about the beginning structure to be like, oh, actually, that's an interesting point that at the time I didn't, as you're watching it, you're like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense with whatever their plan was. But within the context of the storytelling, it's kind of interesting that they start off with him bound in on the street and what you find out later is actually the person who orchestrated the abduction is the one who calls in the tip.
Yes. And charmingly never thought for a moment that there would be consequences to organizing an abduction of a German citizen from Germany to France with an ex-offender and an ex-convicted man and two Russians, one of whom the abductor has to put out of the car.
Because he's afraid he's going to kill him.
He thinks he's going to kill him, remove his genitals at least. And he thinks, I can't drive with this. So there was a very slight comedic moment.
The horrible part of me was kind of like, you know what? I'm with the Russian here. You know, that's the thing. I find that I am like, I should never be put in a situation where I have to try people because don't put me on a jury. Don't do anything because I will be like, yes, cut off his genitals. Do it. That's me.
So, dear listeners, at the beginning, we don't know this though. And that's what I do like about it. Like at the beginning, you still are just kind of like, okay, did this man kill this man's daughter at first, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as you say, we have the title. Bamberski talks about he never thought of having him killed because he didn't see justice being served by the killing of Krombach. But I'm with Beth. Yeah, cut his junk off. Georgian.
Why not? You know?
Yes. Anton tells us they were Georgians, and we all go, that's from Georgia, the country, not Georgia, the state.
Either way. Oh, wait, no.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
So we've touched on Danielle. I think it's good to talk a little about her. Mm-hmm. So in the documentary, we find out that she and Bamberski are married happily. They had two children, Kalinka and Nikola, Kalinka's brother, and that Krombach was their three doors down neighbor
in Germany.
And they began an affair, Danielle and Krombach began an affair. So after the discovery of the affair, they said, oh, we'll stop having the affair. The Bamberskis moved to another city. Danielle said then she had a job which required her to be away from Monday to Friday in yet another city. And Bamberski followed her and discovered she was living from Monday to Friday with Krombach, and at that point they divorced. We hear a little about the divorce. It sounds like it wasn't particularly amicable, but we're not going to judge there. So she lived, she married and lived with Krombach, her two children and his two children, and continued to be his wife until 5 years after the killing of Kalinka. She divorced him because of his infidelities. So that's really what we hear about Danielle. We also hear that she doesn't speak German. And so I think about a person living in a country where you don't speak the language. This is very isolating. And another sort of prong of power that Krombach has over her. We had questions from a devoted listener and past and future guest of the podcast, Lisa Holmes. She would like to hear us discuss the portrayal of Danielle. She says, I think the most shocking moment of the documentary for me was the audio of her saying that if he had been honest about what had happened, he, Krombach, had been honest about what had happened, she might have forgiven him. It seems to be likely she was clearly a victim of this guy as well, but she's sort of portrayed as a villain, question mark.
So the crux of this and the beginning of this long journey is Kalinka's murder. And what we're told like 10 minutes into the documentary, as somebody with a science background, I was like, this makes no sense. But so what happens is we're told that paramedics rush to both Krombach and Danielle's house to find that Kalinka is unresponsive. They tell the when the responders get there, she's already stiff, which means she's in rigor mortis. And then they ask the doctor, like they see that she has like a needle or something sticking out of her arm. They ask the doctor, well, what did you give her? And the doctor says, you know, she had been out in the sun all day. I thought it was heat stroke. So I gave her some calcium to help. Now, again, a nosy person like me, who also has a science background, I was like, calcium for a heat stroke? You know, I had to Google that. And that did, nowhere did it say you drink a heat stroke with calcium. And that was from the moment, like, at least for me, I wonder for you, Sarah and Beth, I was like, oh, something is fishy here. I mean, we knew going in that hopefully there would be something fishy because the father that's telling the story is so adamant that his daughter was killed. But just from jump, you're like, how can y'all look at this and not think that something weird is going on here? So they get to the autopsy. Well, they perform an autopsy on the body. The father, who he was still living in France, he flies to Germany and he asked for a copy of the autopsy. The mother, Danielle, who Lisa is asking about, she gives him a copy of the autopsy. But as he's reading it, he's like, none of this makes sense. He's trying to get more information from Danielle and Krombach, and they're both just also, like,
sorry to interrupt, but it also took him a long time to get the autopsy. Like he kept badgering them, and eventually they sent one to him.
Yes, exactly. And it just starts the scene where Danielle does not seem very I can see why Lisa might think she's portrayed as a villain, because in the initial early stages, it really just seemed like she was just kind of like, it was an accident. Doesn't matter. Let's move on type of thing. I really got that type of vibe that the documentary is trying to say, that she really is just trying to move past everything. So Danielle's complacency might look as complicity, you know, here. And I think Bamberski himself just wanted answers. And when he gets this autopsy report, one of the main things they say is, like, they say that they can't say what she died of, like a cause of death, even though it says that the dinner from her stomach, 400 mls of the dinner that was in her stomach, went up her windpipe and then was found in her lungs. So she regurgitated and basically choked to death by asphyxiation because of that. And again, somebody science background who heard that, I was like, interesting, because you only really see those types of deaths in overdoses or, you know, seizure related deaths. You know, I'm saying, like, that's why when people say, if, you know, if you're overdosing, turn them to the side so that they don't, you know, choke or swallow or yes. So even then, I mean, that was in the inkling of the back of my head, like, there's something happened here. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't really put the pieces together until we got further along, that we had confirmation that he was indeed drugging people. But for the authorities to say that, oh, we talked to Danielle, we talked to Krombach, it seems like it was just a natural accident, case closed, you know, and it takes Bamberski and the French police to kind of like, be like, no, I think they went over the autopsy. Sarah said that they also found possible sexual abuse, signs of sexual abuse by bruising on her labia. And this is what really just kickstarts everything. And it was a journey, man. Danielle's, it was a journey, because everything we got from her up until the end was she just kind of, it felt like she just wanted out of it. She didn't want any part of this. And they said, like, the reporter who interviewed her and interviewed all three of them basically said she did not want any part of it. And it's sad. And the end was even worse once she realized that she was actually living with a rapist, and she herself was getting drugged so that he can then rape a 16-year-old neighbor. I will not say that it was a consensual relationship, because it was a 16-year-old that he was having a sexual affair with, raping. And so she, I agree with Lisa. It was really sad for her to be like, to be like, oh, if he would have told me it was an accident, it would have been better. I don't know why he did all of this. It's like, wake up.
I think that she clearly is a victim. There's a lot of power used against her, all of that. And also, she's clearly going through PTSD and trauma in her own way, right? and trying to deal with that. I think it's a pretty natural response for some people to just want to move past everything, something that's so traumatic, like losing a child. In the moment, it sounds like when the paramedics arrive that she or and the nurses arrive and such that she's distraught. So it's not like she, it's not like her husband is trying to tell her anything to calm her down. Like he's stoic in the way that you would expect a doctor to be around death. Like we're, doctors are literally trained to have manage emotions like that because they're around death and dying so often. That doesn't mean that, you know, they're robots, but I feel like the scene is painted that she's clearly loved her daughter and that this was clearly very painful. What it exacerbates this, of course, is we know that it sounds like the divorce from her first husband was not the best relationship. It didn't happen very amicably. So I really feel like there's feelings of resentment. There's probably feelings that are resentment's a feeling that you, an emotion that you manifest over time. It's not something that's fleeting like anger. You get angry and then you cool down. Resentment, something that you continually have, and the longer you have it, the stronger it gets. And I feel like whatever he was going to say, she wasn't going to believe it. She's also in this position of power with Krumbach, and he's clearly abusing all the women. And then you're also living in a society where doctors are held at such a high esteem and regard, and she's clearly in a comfortable socioeconomic status, and there clearly he's charming, and he'd use, I mean, so, and she that doesn't part. Speak the language, and there's these things that I think that she's through trauma putting a blind eye to it and just saying, I need to do this in order to heal myself without actually having the capacity. And I do think it's a lack of capacity to understand and feel for everything else that's happening in the situation, to be able to open her eyes, because it's just going to make her fall even further down where she's at.
She also has her son, Nicola, to mm-hmm. think about. He's still there with them. He's younger than Kalinka, so he would have been in his early teens. Mm-hmm. So there's the idea of protecting, whatever that means, him as well. Yeah. I don't know that the documentary painted her as a villain, but it didn't go into any of the stuff that you're talking about, Beth and Mari. And that
other than empath, I think she gleaned that.
She really got that,
But I don't know if I saw it.
No, it's not 100%. That's not in the documentary. I'm filling in gaps. And I'm filling in gaps where I would like to think it is, because it would be so callous for somebody to say, I could have forgiven you for raping and killing my daughter if you had just been honest about it. Like, imagine, like, that is such a, what a stance. Contrast that with the father who spends, 30 some years to just bring this man to legal justice. Doesn't want to kill him, but wants him to see justice. That is so vastly different. And I mean, I've grown up and around, and I've been very, very privileged in my life to have parents that would do anything for me. I mean, I know that that's not the common thing all over the place. So I know I'm in a very privileged position when I say this, but my parents would give me every cent they have. They would seek justice. They would house me if I needed it. Even if I was the cause of my own issues, they would help me. I can't imagine. I cannot imagine one of them being like, I would forgive if you had just, you know, admitted to it, that you like raped and killed her. Now, I'm not saying that forgiveness is a powerful tool, and I'm not saying that forgiveness itself is weakness. Not at all. It's weird that she would have like stayed with him potentially. I mean, it was the infidelity. Like, she leaves him because of an infidelity, but like, he raped your daughter. Like, that, I have to believe there's trauma or something there, because we don't get the background. So that's why I fill in those blanks.
Neither the autopsy stated, you know, sexual assault. There was trauma to the outer labia. You know, come on. She wasn't riding a horse. And then the thing that wasn't clear to me as why they had the disinterment, but they did disinter her some 5 years later after she died and re-examined the body. The organs were missing and the outer labia were also missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they collected samples from her genitalia. Don't know what they did with it. Like very, very sketchy. And that's what you were talking about. The one lawyer who was like, oh, did he have five accomplices? Again, I don't think you need to be consciously an accomplice. If you just want to get something over with, if you don't want to accuse an acclaimed doctor of something, you just close the file and hope nobody looks. The problem in here is somebody looked. Bamberski, the father, was very adamant about finding out what happened. And I think that's just where they ran into the wall, because they could have probably gone away with shoddy police work, shoddy medical work, shoddy autopsy in Germany, if he hadn't have pressed the issue, brought the autopsy report back to France and get her body, Sarah said, disinterred, in order for it to continue. So again, laziness and wanting to just wash your hands clean of it is a powerful motivator when it comes to legal and law enforcement, because they'd much rather not deal with it.
And for Danielle, the sexual assault of her daughter is not, in her mind, proven until 39 years later. So she was able, and I think Beth's given us a really good picture of what it must be like to be in that very unsafe environment.
Yeah.
To be sort of saving your own life, you may need to not believe that your husband, a man that you trusted with your own life and the life of your young children, would do this.
I also think he just had a really, really powerful hold on her. Yeah. Like, I mean, again, we said it in the most disgusting part that I think we all thought of was people called him very charming and magnetic. And we've seen in the documentary, they show several videos of him talking. Unfortunately, most of the videos when he's talking that were being shown is when he's talking about admitting to raping a 16-year-old, admitting that, talking about the case and that Danielle only left him because of the infidelity. I can look at what I'm seeing and see why people would be drawn to him. You know what I'm saying? He's very animated. He's very smirky. He has that confidence that I am admitting to a crime, but nothing's going to happen to me. That cocky confidence that draws people in. It's that almost that cult leader mystique. I can see how he can have that pull. And it truly seems like he had it on her, because just their history of having an affair in Germany, her moving to France, and her to continue that affair and hiding that affair with him in France. And then again, even after they get divorced, for him cheating, not the accidental death at this point to her, the accidental death of her daughter, 5 years later, she's still messing with him until that 5 years. So there clearly was a pull that he had on her that she could not break and did not, realize what was happening again until we saw her later in the documentary in court after all of those women testified against him. And she finally is like, oh, wow, he really was a pervert.
The 5 years after Kalinka's death is just ringing a faint bell with me now, too. And I'm thinking about women in domestically violent situations, which she is. I mean, she's being drugged and she's living with this disgusting man. So 5 years after Kalinka's death, Nicola would have been 17 or 18. So the timing is very interesting there as well. If she was stopping down to protect her other child, I suppose. One way of protecting would have been to leave, but in a country that she didn't speak the language, she wasn't working. I mean, I can sort of see a lot of factors going in there. So
what I think is so interesting here is that both the father and the stepfather have very different personalities. Mm-hmm. And I think she probably went from having a partner who saw everything through, seemed to have a very serious of purpose, and then go from everything must be planned or whatever to somebody who just seemed to kind of live in the moment. Mm-hmm. I think that that's that charisma. And then there's the other parts of it. Oh, it's the doctor and those parts too. And I think that we have to remember that even after she divorces Krombach, she literally still like defends him. So it's not like I don't think that she's leaving because she wasn't even aware that she was being drugged until decades later. So I don't think that she's leaving for her child or for, I think she's literally leaving because she's like, I thought I was his only one.
Truly.
Right.
Truly.
Mm-hmm. Which I still think is completely such a defense mechanism to have, whether it's a defense mechanism of I was duped and I don't want to admit that I was duped, so I'm just gonna whatever. But the fact is, he was like, even if you admit that, oh, it would have been awful if he had been raping my daughter, like, that is extramarital. Like, I don't know what else is, like, what is more important. So she's such an interesting figure, and we don't get to know her story. We don't get to hear her perspective. And therefore, we have to fill in gaps ourselves. But I ultimately think that I don't know if that's necessarily fair. I don't know if maybe if I'm just being like super sympathetic, like woman to woman or whatever the case might be. I think there's a lot of power dynamics. We know that he's like the most misogynistic man. Like the way that he's talking to the reporter and being like, thank God you're a blonde when you came in. If you hadn't been, I wouldn't have given you this interview. Like, so misogynistic, but yet he's saying it because he has that cockiness that Mari's talking about. Mm-hmm. And anybody who can mask that cockiness and have people give him the respect that he deserves, like, that's a narcissist. And that's somebody who infamously is hard to break away from when you're in love with them, when they have a hold over you in any capacity. So I think that she's such an interesting character, but I don't think that it's even really at the end of the day super fair for us to like say whether or not she's a full victim. I think she has to be in some capacity. She's being drugged and abused in that way. Of course she's a victim. She's definitely going through trauma with her daughter. But what part did she potentially play with her complicity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? I mean, you mentioned that the German TV journalist Barbara Volkel, who is the only one to have had an interview with Krombach, and yes, lucky she's a blonde, she gives us a really good kind of cultural marker, I think. She talks about, and we have the video of, a moment in the German parliament where a woman is saying, will you change the law so that rape inside marriage is illegal? And the politician she's speaking to says no, at which point the entire parliament, men and women, clap and cheer.
Mm-hmm. And laugh.
Yep. Yes. So really she was one of the talking heads I really appreciated. Partly she's a journalist, so she has that overview. But she was a woman and she was a German woman, so I think she brought a lot of the cultural idea to us, like this is the world in which all of these things happened. And I believe, I should have looked at the date, but I believe that a question about making marital rape illegal was not 1975. It was much more recent than that.
And that's the thing. I was just looking this up because I need to amend an earlier statement where I said, wow, I think like the U.S. was ahead of this. I think the U.S. was right along with Germany when I'm looking at this. It looks like in this prior to the 1970s, marital rape was legal in the United States and every state. And then starting in the 70s, it trickled throughout the states. And then in 1993, the last states adopted that marital rape would be illegal. So all of this kind of aligns with when Germany is going through this whole conversation itself, politically speaking. And then on top of that, when you're also discussing, you know, the status of being a doctor and having like, who's going to believe you, even if it is illegal, right? Like you have somebody who society is putting up on a pedestal, isn't questioning. The paramedics and the nurses aren't questioning what he's doing to give calcium. Like there's literally nobody who's challenging him. So even if she were in a position where she, A, was aware that she was being drugged, and B, tried to press charges, she would not at this time in Germany be able to do anything about it, I don't think. I think that she could have tried, but I don't think that they would have listened to her case. It would have been so early in the adoption process.
Yeah, all the lawyers that we see look like they cost money. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. All the French maîtres and the German lawyers, they all look like they cost money. So for someone like Danielle, what were her resources, you know, to make this charge?
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Bambersky's with us the whole way.
Yeah.
He's very much the narrator. He brings us Kalinka in the beginning, that her name has a music to it. What a wonderful girl she was. We are in danger of losing Kalinka, I think, along the way, but Bambersky always brings it back to her, and I'm grateful for that. So he gets this great idea. He's going to advertise for an accomplice, and this is where we now re-meet Anton the barman, who is a father himself. He's not going to charge for the abduction. He, in fact, is going to cover the 2,000 euro fee for his two Russians. He wants to do it because of this idea of the father bond. What was your take on Bambersky's naivete that this was something he could be charged with, Beth?
I think it's so fascinating. For somebody who has spent so much time looking at legalities of all of these different crimes and having to look at the French system and the German system of their legal systems, it's interesting that he doesn't think, if I orchestrate this, I won't get in trouble. But I also think that this is somebody who, once again, is kind of blinded by the fact that, like, he's just blinded by getting justice, that he's like, nobody would charge me because this is a just thing. We just need to get them over. We need to get him over into this, into France, and then we're good to go. And there's a part of me, I don't know if I believe him in the documentary. I really think that Bambersky really is trying to put it on a little bit in an attempt. Because again, we have to always remember that documentaries and docuseries and such are trying to give a perspective. And it very well could be that, you know, he's playing up his part as well. Now, I'm not saying that, don't get me wrong, I think morally speaking, he did the right thing. but I don't, legally speaking, like, no. And we always have to remember that legally speaking, it doesn't make it always right. Morally speaking, doesn't always make things right as well legally. So it's interesting to me that he flirts with this idea that, I'm not going to get in trouble, because I'm not the one doing it. But if you're orchestrating it, it's like anybody who hires a hitman, like, you get in trouble if that gets caught. Like, yeah, the hitman did the crime, but they did it because you're the one who orchestrated it. So you might as well have pulled the trigger. So I just think that that's a really interesting perspective to have. But again, I'm not mad at him for it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good point to bring up, Beth, like about the objectivity of documentaries, because this documentary is called My Daughter's Killer. So and we clearly get it from his point of view. It's his work that brought the man to justice, so. Currently, at this point, Krombach has been charged in France. He has been sentenced to five 15 years in jail in France, but he escapes to Germany, and Germany doesn't send him back. He's just, you know, hopping from town to town. And he's currently, right now, he doesn't have a license. I'm pretty sure this is at the point where he had been taking his medical license away, but he's still practicing. But he just knows as long as he doesn't step foot in France, he doesn't have to face those penalties. And Bamberski knows this too. And so Bamberski and Anton get together and plan this abduction. And I can see that. I can definitely see it be like, oh, I just asked them to grab him and bring him to France. And then, you know, and they kind of present it like that. They take us through. Anton does an amazing job of taking us through the abduction, minus the beating part. Like, I thought that was very funny.
That came out of nowhere. They're like, oh, he was terribly beaten. I was like, where was that, Anton? He didn't say that at all.
Anton gives us a blow by blow of the abduction. Oh, the Russians get him. We tie him. He's in the back. The Russians are in the back. I tell one of the Russians or Georgians, whichever one, to get out. No offense to our Russian and Georgian listeners. I know there is a difference. I do understand that. It seemed like Anton didn't know which one they were. So that's why we're a little confused. Mud,
yes.
Yeah. And so, like, I mean, everything, like, oh, there's an alley. We were like, oh, Malouz will drop him there. And then he's like, oh, I called Bamberski and tell him, hey, call them to tell them that he's in the back. And then that is when we get the full 911 version. That's when we get the full, like, start of the investigation. And that's when, because I was like, wait, what? Yeah, what happened to the beating part? We just left that part out, Anton. It was very interesting. And it, again, we're playing it for laughs here because this is, you know, an entertainment podcast. But also it was kind of funny.
Well, the victim of the beating and genital removal, putative genital removal, is someone that we are not at all fond of.
Exactly.
So the documentary ends with the question to Bamberski, what would you say to another father? And this floored me. He said, 39 years, don't waste your life. That he had thought he was Don Quixote tilting at windmills, but that in fact it had been a sort of a violent 39 years to himself. And what do we think of this ending? I'll go to you, Beth.
Okay, so my interpretation, this is probably not correct. I thought he was basically being like, don't wait 39 years. If you know who did it, just make sure you abduct him, get him done. That was my initial.
I love that.
I was like, you know what? Bamberski, you're a good guy. I like that. That's great. No, I think honestly what he, like so many others, are saying, don't let, you know, the ghosts of your past, literal ghosts or things that you have done or said in the past, haunt you and prevent you from living. The dead don't want you to not live, right? And I think that when you are so laser focused on something to the point that Bamberski was, there's no way you can, like, I don't know how to say properly live, because who's to say how you properly live, but I don't know how you move forward in a way. It's kind of like the stories that we hear about spirits that are unable to pass on to the next realm, right? So the idea that ghosts or spirits, the ones that we hear and interact with, are the ones potentially are ones that haven't passed on to the next realm. It's almost like he's put himself into that mentality. He can't move on, but he's still living because he's so dead set on, let's make sure we get justice. But he doesn't want justice to come in the form of revenge. He wants it to come in the form of legal justice. And I think that that's what's so interesting about this. So many other people would say, I want to avenge this person or get revenge. I want this person to die. I want this person to have pain. Then you hear from people who say, no, I want the legal justice. But as we've also discussed in this podcast, is legal justice always the same as moral justice? Like, there's so many questions to be answered here. And I think that it's just really interesting to hear somebody who spent decades. This is all he did. Did he just not feel like it was worth it all at the end? That's what I don't understand and know. And if that's the case, does he feel like he wasted his ability to live? Or does he feel like this was the right move? for me, but it's not the right move for everybody else.
Yeah, that was my feeling. I think he felt that for him, he could not have acted in another way, but that he wouldn't recommend it for anyone else. I mean, it has to be said, yes, his daughter's killer came to justice, but the victims of Crombach sexual assault also had their day in court. And as we know, 16 women have since come forward as well, so they can now be heard and believed. So there's a ripple effect from Bamberski's laser focus just on his daughter's killer to embrace and allow the voices of these other women to be heard. Mari, your final thoughts?
Yes, thank you. That leads perfectly into my final thoughts, because that's what I wanted to go to. I wanted to go to the victims, because we did hear from the victims in this, and I don't want it to seem like we're excluding them from our discussion, because I think it's very vital. If you want to know why we are jubilant at the ending, it's because we go through the journey of finding out the horrible things he's done to these victims and why he deserved every single minute he spent in jail. And it just also is frustrating, because if they had stopped him around the time of Kalinka's murder, then a lot of the victims that we saw on the screen would not have been victims of his. He continued to sexually assault and victimize women all around Germany years after Kalinka's murder. And it's just very unfortunate that none of this was taken seriously immediately, so that these women's lives wouldn't be horrendously affected the way that they were. But like Sarah said, they got their chance to confront him. Some of them did in court. I don't want to paraphrase any of their journeys. So definitely go and watch the documentary, because I think the documentary did give plenty of time. They could have maybe given more. You can always give more time to victims. But I think they did give plenty of time to a lot of his victims that were still with us, and clearly established a pattern of behavior that lasted decades in order for us to feel that justice was, you know, at least served here, and to be like, maybe they should have finished the job. I just wanted to say, we got to include the victims in here.
That's a really, really great call. I think that because the title is My Daughter's Killer, we both get the idea that the documentary ultimately is about Bamberski and Crombach. But at the end of the day, it's about the women. It is about the victims. It is about Kalinka, and it's about all the other women who were victims. Whether we see their faces, hear their stories or not, they're all valid. And I think that sometimes that's maybe the other drawback I think I would have for this documentary as we think about it. It's like you said, could have used some more time talking about the victims, but focusing on the fact that it ultimately they repeat it multiple times. Oh yeah, he was assaulting these other women, and this was a problem. He was doing this. It's like, okay. Yeah, we get it. He was awful. But what's the victim's story on this? Did they feel like they got justice? Did they feel vindicated? Do they feel like the abduction was worth it? Those would have been the things that I think would have been a really fascinating ending with Bamberski as well.
Yeah, then you get your three-part documentary, then Mari doesn't want to watch it.
Fair enough. Right.
So, Beth, how many magnifying glasses are you going to rate My Daughter's Killer out of a possible five? Five being the best.
I'm going to give this a 4. I thought this was really great. It's a really quick watch. It's like an hour and 25 minutes or something like that. I think the storytelling is really great. The only issues I've said before, sometimes I don't know who's talking, but I honestly think that if you just go back and kind of rewatch some aspects, it's not bad at all. I would definitely suggest anybody give this a watch. It's really easy if you're not really into consuming all things true crime. This is a really easy one to watch and get into. There's a lot of really interesting cultural aspects of this that, you know, from an American point of view, really helped to challenge my thoughts and perceptions. As a side note, I don't know if this is an American point of view of things, or I think it might also be British, because I spent a lot of time in Britain and college, but I always felt like, oh, French men are the ones that are spontaneous and blah, blah, blah. And the Germans are the ones that will see things through. And it's kind of interesting that the two, Bumperski and Krombach, are completely flipped. So just as a side note there, that tells you you can't really listen to stereotypes. But yeah, I would give this a 4 out of 5 magnifying glasses.
Fantastic. Mari, what's your magnifying glass rating?
Okay. I am actually going to give this a 5. A 5 out of 5. Yes. Ding, ding, ding. Where's the bell?
Amazing. You're second only. Incredible.
I know. The first one, I can't remember what it was. Again, nobody has did the work for us and went back and listed all of our ratings. Where are our fans that do that for us? If Rob asked, I think y'all would have done it. No. I truly, truly, really like this documentary. I think it's because I've just been, because this is our job, you know, I've been consuming so many true crime documentaries, docuseries, and stuff like that. This truly kind of had everything I asked for. I said it is a feature length that was not long. It was like, what, an hour and 10, hour 15?
Something like, it's like an hour and 20 or something like that. It wasn't 20, bad at all. Sorry.
Yeah, it wasn't, it was so easily digestible. It had 911 calls that actually like made the story better in a sense. There was no gratuitous crime scene photos. Everything felt intentional. The way that they unfolded the story just was just a masterclass. Like I didn't feel duped. I didn't feel like I was tricked. I didn't feel like they were trying to make me feel something emotionally, or, you know, or twist my emotions. I just thought it was like, and then it was also just a regular documentary format. It sometimes formats like this can get boring. Like we talked with Fruitcake Fraud. It's that regular format where, you know, we're seeing the documentary happen. Luckily there are no reenactments.
There are plenty of reenactments. They are so good.
They're so good.
They are so good.
And it was just like, I just thought it was great. I really, truly did. And I really liked the storytelling. They did not have to fudge the timeline. I think that they told everything in a succinct manner, even if they were jumping back. I don't know. I just thought it was great storytelling. So I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
I think the last one the first one and the only one till now you gave a 5.2 was Undercurrent.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm with both of you. I'm very high on this documentary. I'm going to give it a 4.5. Ooh. I think just the production of it was really very good. It's very nice to look at, you know, that's important. And yes, we are famously anti-reenactments.
Yeah.
There are the reenactments that they have, and there are quite a lot, are so well done.
Just
they're
the dry.
So integrated. That yes, that they really helped the story. And as Mari said, we don't like the 911 calls or 000, as it would be. Actually, 000 here, I don't know what it is in Europe.
999, right?
999, that's England. Anyway, if you're in a different country. Okay, PSA for Americans, if you're in a different country, figure out what the emergency number is. It's not 911.
Yes.
But we have the emergency call, which we don't like. And we don't like the reenactments generally. Here, both of those are used to such great effect. Mm-hmm. So I think as a piece of work as a whole, it's really well produced, really, really well put together. Mm-hmm. And I found the story, which I did not know, captivating, enraging, sad-making. It was all the things. Yeah. And then the sort of the light relief of Anton and the Georgians in the car with the knife, which was sort of like a bit of black comedy going on there.
Yeah.
And this sort of charming moment that they didn't have to put in but worked thematically, which is Anton in jail in Austria and Anton's father coming and saying, "I'm proud of you," which is like another director might not have used that quote, but to me it just put this button on what had started. It started also with Anton, what would a father do? It asked the question and then spent 84 minutes answering the question, this. So it wasn't one of those hooks and then nothing happens. What would a father do? A father would do this. So, yes, 4.5 for me. Now, Beth, you have brought us a mini review of a fascinating true crime product. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I would love to recommend that everybody go check out on HBO, HBO Max. There is a documentary called Who Killed Garrett Phillips? I believe it's a two-part series, but I could be wrong. I'm misremembering if it's not. Essentially, what's so interesting about that documentary is that it's about a 12-year-old named Garrett Phillips, who on October 24th in 2011, in the small town of Potsdam, New York, at the very top of New York State, was murdered in his home. The police quickly suspect Nick Hillary, also who was a Black Jamaican man, who was a soccer coach at Clarkson University. He was the alum of St. Lawrence University, which is where I work. And a lot of the figures in this documentary are actually surrounding the towns that I grew up around and went to college in. Some of the players in this, like Mary Rain, who is the defense attorney, who I strongly dislike as a human and as a person who was the defense attorney in this. She's horrible. But anyway, it's a really interesting story. It really talks a lot about racial prejudice, specifically in a white, poor, rural area of New York State. They do a really good job of painting what this area looks like. A lot of people aren't aware what the farthest part of New York State looks like, let alone what the makeup of it is, what the history of it is. They give a really good cultural background to it, how that can play into the way that the cops illegally detained Nick Hillary, how the legal teams messed up, honestly, quite a few of the details. But you also have the really horrific interviews with the mother, Tandy Cyrus, and her family, who just want justice for their son. And they thoroughly believe that Nick Hillary, who was Tandy's ex-boyfriend, is the one that commits the crime. Interestingly enough, her other ex-boyfriend is a police officer in the town, who is not a suspect and also attends so many of the different things he shouldn't as someone who is so close to her and to this case. And there's a lot of people out there who think maybe he's the one that murdered Garrett Phillips. And to this day, it's still a cold case. We don't really know what has happened there. There's lots of theories, whether or not they put it out in the documentary or not. There's theories that maybe this was foul play or from another kid that managed to escape. They were on the second floor. They know that whoever was there had to have dropped down from a window. And they're thinking maybe a child could have done that. Another middle school age student could have dropped down and maybe not have gotten as hurt as maybe an adult would have and been able to run away, who also might have freaked out in a way if there was an accident that happened. So there's a lot of different theories that are still out there. There's a lot of people who I happen to know who were involved in the story. Lots of people, regardless of how you feel about them in the documentary, who are good people who have had horrible things happen to them. One of the board members of the university I work for, St. Lawrence University, provided all the legal fees for Nick Hillary because she believed in him so much. A lot of his lawyers end up being fellow alums from the soccer team that he played on. So for me, it's a really interesting story, not only of the community I largely identify myself with St. Lawrence, but also the North Country where I grew up and seeing some of the legal faults that happened in the system, seeing racism present itself in a legal capacity, seeing how the media played a role, seeing how all of this kind of comes together. It's a really fascinating story. And I would just also add by saying that my personal feelings align with the documentary. But as we say before, documentaries are not objective. There's a point of view that they're trying to pull across. This is very pro Nick, I would say. It's very which I personally align and agree with, but I know that there are plenty of people who don't. You will still drive around Potsdam and Canton, New York, and see signs all over the place that say justice for Garrett. This is not a case that people take lightly up there. This is very divisive. It continues to be today. A lot of people feel like justice was not served. A lot of people feel like justice was served and that Nick was found not guilty legally. So it's a really interesting case. If you are interested in learning more about it, bring some tissues. It's very emotional. And I really encourage you to also challenge your own biases and perceptions that you have as you watch this. I know I had to, and some of it's because it hits super home to me. but I think that it's a really fascinating story.
Oh, wonderful. We'll put all that in the show notes so people can look that up. At Crime Scene, we're eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's Scene, S-E-E-N. Email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at Crime Scene Podcast. Beth, what have you got going on and where can the people find you?
Sure. You can follow me on all my social media accounts at AugustaWind11. So I'm on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. You can follow me all those great places there. I also, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, I cover Drag Race, which is like finally not happening right now. but then they also like released on the day that we're recording this, they released that like season 15 is going to have like so many episodes, and so is All Stars 8. And so I just don't think I'm ever going to have a break once they start, which is fine because I love Drag Race. But you can catch me there. You can also catch me on my two other podcasts, My Weekly Meltdown with Allison Kelly and Tyler Lyons. And you can also catch me on Hot Mess Moments with Dylan Zahner, especially if you are queer. You'll probably love that one because we're just hot queer messes on that. We just are ridiculous.
And if you miss a Drag Race, you can hop on to Drag Race Down Under. And also Super Secret Celebrity Masked Drag
Race for the Gods.
Race for the Gods.
Yeah.
Boots the house down.
The house down boots for your nerve, hunty. Yes.
That's there's Drag Race everywhere. you can't cover it all. Maybe you can. Mari, what about you? Where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two. Follow me there for all of my Big Brother 24 coverage. So every time I go live with Taryn and the gang for Big Brother coverage, I'll let you know on there. I was recently on Nothing But Netflix to talk about Day Shift with Chappelle and Rob. So go check that out. If you like vampire movies, tune in and listen to us break that down. Other than that, you can also follow us on our new Instagram account. Go to Crime Scene Podcast on Instagram to see all of the pictures from this week's documentary. Leave your comments there. Let us know what you think. So again, that's Instagram at Crime Scene Podcast. That's Crime S-E-E-N Podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine, where you can hear everything that I'm doing because I am not shy about letting you know. We'll announce our documentary for next week on Twitter, so follow us at Crime Scene RHAP to find out what it is so you can watch it and send us your comments and questions. Thanks to Beth for joining us, to Will from America for the theme music, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time, case
closed.